A History of Central Banking by Stephen Goodson. Chapter 5, The Great Depression. Quote, capital must protect itself in every possible way, both by a combination and legislation. Debts must be collected, mortgages foreclosed as rapidly as possible. When, through process of law, the common people lose their homes, they will become more docile and more easily governed through the strong arm of the government, applied by a central power of wealth under leading financiers. These truths are well known among our principal men who are now engaged in forming an imperialism to govern the world. By dividing the voters through the political party system, we can get them to expend their energies in fighting for questions of no importance. It is thus, by discreet action, we can ensure for ourselves that which has been so well planned and so successfully accomplished. Unquote. Montagu Norman, Governor of the Bank of England, addressing the United States Bankers Association, New York, Idaho, Leader, 26th of August, 1924. By the turn of the 20th century, there were still only 18 central banks. Swedish Riksbank, 1668, Bank of England, 1694, Banco de España, 1782, Bank de France, 1800, Bank of Finland, 1812, Die Niederländische Bank, 1814, Norges Bank, 1816, Österreichische National Bank, 1816, Denmark's National Bank, 1818, Banco de Portugal, 1846, National Bank of Belgium, 1850, Bank of Indonesia, formerly Java Bank, 1828, German Reichsbank, 1876, Bulgarian National Bank, 1879, National Bank of Romania, 1880, Bank of Japan, 1882, National Bank of Serbia, 1884, and the Banca d'Italia, 1893. In 1922, a conference was held in Genoa from the 10th of April to the 19th of May, and attended by heads of state, governors of the Bank of England, Bank de France, and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and a host of other international bankers. At this conference, it was resolved to set up central banks in all countries where they were not in existence. The governor of the Bank of England, Montagu Norman, insisted that the central banks should be independent of their governments. A.N. Field, in All These Things, summarizes this significant occasion as follows. Quote, despite the audacity of these proceedings, they were entirely successful. The paid economist duly discovered that reserve banks were marvelous scientific improvements. The newspapers joined in the chorus of applause, and the politicians of the various states behaved as so many bellwethers leading the sheep to the slaughterhouse. The fact was entirely overlooked that the financiers are in no sense public servants, but simply the paid agents of the shareholders in a banking company whose interests need not in the least be identical with the national interest. Unquote. The Bank for International Settlements. The number of new central banks increased, particularly, quote, after the establishment of the Bank for International Settlements at Basel early in 1930, when central reserve banks, more or less independent of the governments of the countries in which they were situated, sprang up like mushrooms all over the world amid a chorus of approval from deluded governments and people whom these banks were intended to reduce to servitude. Unquote. I don't know where the quote started. Oh, it did up there. Never mind. The original purpose of the BIS was to facilitate German reparations payments in terms of the Treaty of Versailles, but once the artificially contrived Great Depression started to take effect and the National Socialists assumed power in January 1933, all payments ceased, and the BIS had to find a new direction, the fostering of monetary cooperation. In reality, the BIS guides and directs the centrally planned global financial system through the central banks of each country, of which 60 are affiliated to it. The headquarters of the bank are in Basel, Switzerland, and they are currently housed in an ugly 18-story building which looks like the cooling tower of a power station. It is an unelected, unaccountable central bank of the central bankers, which has complete immunity from national laws and taxation and has its own private police force. Furthermore, in terms of rights granted by an agreement with the Swiss Federal Council, all of the bank's archives, documents, and electronic data are inviolable at all times and in all places. This agreement dates back to Article X of Paragraph 2 of the Hague Protocol, which was signed on the 31st of August, 1929, and states that, quote, "The bank, its property and assets, and also the deposits of other funds entrusted to it on the territory of or dependent on the administration of, shall be immune from any disabilities and from any restrictive measures such as censorship, requisition, seizure, or confiscation. In time of peace or war, reprisals, prohibition, or restriction of export of gold or currency and other similar interferences, restrictions, or prohibitions," unquote. Bi-monthly meetings where the global economy is discussed are held in absolute secrecy. There is no written agenda unless one of the statutes of the bank requires revision and minutes are not kept. The principal functions of the bank are ostensibly 1. Facilitating collaboration amongst central banks by means of accords. 2. Promoting financial stability. 3. Research on policy issues. 4. Acting as a counterparty for central banks in their financial transactions. 5. Serving as an agent or trustee in connection with the international financial operations. However, the true nature of the BIS was revealed in the book Tragedy and Hope, written by insider professional Carol Quigley of Georgetown University, who wrote as follows, quote, "In addition to these pragmatic goals, the powers of financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim, none the less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This system was to be controlled in a feudalist fashion by the central banks of the world, acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at in frequent private meetings and conferences. The apex of the system was to be the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations. Each central bank in the hands of men like Montagu Norman of the Bank of England, Benjamin Strong of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, Charles Rist of the Bank of France, and Hjalmar Schacht of the Reichsbank sought to dominate its government by its ability to control treasury loans, to manipulate foreign exchanges, to influence the level of economic activity in the country, and to influence cooperative politicians by subsequent economic rewards in the business world." Unquote. As Professor Quigley predicted back in 1966, the ultimate aim of the BIS is a single world currency, a one world economic system, and a global government where national laws are no longer applicable or relevant. Control of the bank lies with the House of Rothschild through its investments in various central and private banks. After World War II and the dissolution of the European colonial empires because they were no longer financially sustainable and offered far greater prospects for exploitation and plunder by means of international loans, there was a further proliferation of central banks, and currently their number stands at 157. 8 of these banks are in private ownership: National Bank of Belgium, Bank of Greece, Banca d'Italia, Bank of Japan, South African Reserve Bank, Swiss National Bank, Central Bank of the Republic of Turkey, and the United States Federal Reserve Bank. The coordinated establishment of all these central banks proves beyond doubt that they are, quote-unquote, part of an international money trust. The United States Federal Reserve Bank. Between 1820 and 1910, although there was a temporary spike in prices during the American Civil War of 1861 to 1865, the dollar retained its purchasing power. $1 was still worth $1 90 years later. However, it took a mere 6 years for the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank to destroy the value of the dollar. Between 1914 and 1920, prices rose by 125%, reducing its value by 56.1%. Before casting our attention to the Great Depression, a brief examination of the causes of the first major deflation needs to be considered. In order to rein in prices, a secret bankers' meeting was held on the 18th of May 1920 in Washington, D.C. under the misleading title of the Orderly Deflation Committee of the American Bankers Association. Under the orders of the Federal Reserve Board, without notice or warning, the discount rate rose rapidly from 2% to 9% and beyond. Simultaneously, the Federal Reserve Bank began aggressively to sell government bonds, reducing their value by 20%. The fall in bond prices reduced the value of the reserves of community banks, which were forced to call in all their loans. This resulted in, quote, a terrific liquidation of all agricultural products, and agricultural prices tumbled to ruinously low levels, unquote. At the same time, freight companies owned by the major trusts, such as the Harrimans, increased their railroad rates to such an extent that in some states, freight costs exceeded the cost of farm production. The farm product index dropped by more than half from 244 in May 1920 to 117 a year later. Many farmers were ruined as their overheads remained unchanged and their financial costs soared. The unlimited powers which the Federal Reserve Bank possessed had enabled it to contract the currency and credit of the United States by $2 billion, with the result that, quote, prices were cut in half and confusion and distress reigned, unquote. This policy was carried out with deliberate intent in order to impoverish the agricultural sector by transferring rural money to the urban centers and at the same time reducing America's food independence, thereby making it vulnerable to the intrigues and whims of financial speculators and swindlers. In July 1921, the Federal Reserve Bank reversed this policy by repurchasing government bonds. However, the damage done to agricultural banks could not be repaired, and the agricultural products remained artificially depressed, with some products being sold below cost of production. In August 1927, the conspirators running the privately owned Federal Reserve Bank decided that it was time to create a new quote-unquote boom. Despite the protestations of 11 of the 12 Federal Reserve banks who perceived the danger, they were ordered to lower their rediscount rates and embark on a massive government bond repurchasing program, the modern equivalent of quantitative easing, to boost the money supply. Hardly any of this newly created money, ex nihilo, went into productive investments, but was poured into the stock market, where the price-to-earnings ratio quickly rose to 20 and in some cases, to 50. The news media and deluded quote-unquote economists announced the arrival of a quote-unquote new era of permanent prosperity and purposefully fanned the flames of speculation as 16 million Americans out of an adult population of 73 million bought and sold shares. On the 9th of March 1929, Paul Warburg, Freemason and founder of the Federal Reserve Bank, advised all member banks, as well as Secretary of the Treasury and fellow Mason Andrew Mellon, to get out of the stock market or sell it short. He informed them that if they acted immediately, they would reap enormous profits as the Dow Jones share index was about to collapse in a titanic plunge. On 24th of October 1929, the Federal Reserve Bank decided to put an end to this orgy of speculation and commence the fleecing of the people. The rediscount rate was suddenly increased to 6%. From nowhere, thousands of orders arrived at the New York Stock Exchange to sell, quote-unquote, at market, a typical stratagem employed by speculators to knock down share prices rapidly. Confidence soon evaporated, and the first intentionally planned Great Depression was in full swing. The decisive point came 6 days later, on the 30th of October 1929, when the Federal Reserve Bank ordered the contraction of brokers' loans in the amount of $2.3 million. The stock exchange went into a tailspin, and by December 1932, the value of its listed securities had fallen by 83.1% from $89 billion to $15 billion. The economic and social consequences of this implosion were devastating. Out of 24,000 banks, 10,000 were crushed out of existence, leaving their depositors ruined. 200,000 companies filed for bankruptcy, and 8.3 million people were thrown into the streets. Within 3 years, 24.9% of the working population was unemployed. The total national income of the United States declined by 40.7% from $81 billion in 1927 to $48 billion in 1932. During the Depression years, an estimated 3 million people died of starvation. The main causes were malnutrition, infectious diseases, starvation, and suicide. When referring to the New York Stock Exchange collapse, which initiated the Depression, Congressman Louis T. McFadden stated with precision, quote, "It was a carefully contrived occurrence. The international bankers sought to bring about a condition of despair so that they might emerge as the rulers of us all," unquote. A.N. Field condemned the worthlessness of central banks and the perverted purposes for which they have been consistently utilized as follows, quote, "Reserve banking as a means of preventing financial crises has thus been a most complete and total failure in the United States. This fact has in no way militated against a world campaign to establish reserve banks in all countries. It has been alleged that the financiers in command of the United States Federal Reserve do not want stable conditions and that the unprecedented booms and slumps since its establishment have been deliberately caused. It is at least certain that those in control of the system have raised the strongest objections to every one of the numerous attempts made in Congress to write an instruction into the law directing the Federal Reserve to use its tremendous powers to maintain the purchasing power of its money at a stable level," unquote. In a newspaper article in the Financial Times written in 1930, Professor Carl Gustav Cassel of Stockholm University, Sweden, remarked, quote, "Practically absolute power over the welfare of the world has been placed in the hands of the Federal Reserve Board, and one is appalled to see the apparently haphazard manner in which the board uses this power, how ignorant it is of the aim of which ought to dictate American monetary policy," unquote. Finally, in this section, we may pause to reflect on a thunderous speech given on Friday, the 10th of June, 1932, in the United States House of Representatives by the former chairman of the House Banking and Currency Committee, 1920 to 1931, the Honorable Louis T. McFadden. Quote, "Mr. Chairman, we have in this country one of the most corrupt institutions the world has ever known. I refer to the Federal Reserve Board and the Federal Reserve Banks. The Federal Reserve Board, a government board, has cheated the government of the United States and the people of the United States out of enough money to pay the national debt. The depredations and the iniquities of the Federal Reserve Board and the Federal Reserve Banks acting together have cost this country enough money to pay the national debt several times over. This evil institution has impoverished and ruined the people of the United States, has bankrupted itself, and has practically bankrupted our government. It has done this through the defects of the law under which it operates, through the maladministration of that law by the Federal Reserve Board, and through the corrupt practices of the moneyed vultures who control it. Some people think the Federal Reserve Banks are United States government institutions. They are not government institutions. They are private credit monopolies which prey upon the people of the United States for the benefit of themselves and their foreign customers. Foreign and domestic speculators and swindlers and rich and predatory moneylenders. In that dark crew of financial pirates, there are those who would cut a man's throat to get a dollar out of his pocket. There are those who send money into the states to buy votes to control our legislation, and there are those who maintain international propaganda for the purpose of deceiving us and of wheedling us into the granting of new concessions, which will permit them to cover up their past misdeeds, set again in motion their gigantic train of crime. Those 12 private credit monopolies were deceitfully and disloyally foisted upon this country by bankers who came here from Europe and who repaid us for our hospitality by undermining our American institutions. Those bankers took money out of this country to finance Japan in a war against Russia. They created a reign of terror in Russia with our money in order to help that war along, instigated the separate peace between Germany and Russia, and thus drove a wedge between the allies of the World War. They financed Trotsky's mass meetings of discontent and rebellion in New York. They paid Trotsky's passage from New York to Russia so that he might assist in the destruction of the Russian Empire. They fomented and instigated the Russian Revolution, and they placed a large fund of American dollars at Trotsky's disposal in one of their branch banks in Sweden so that through him, Russian homes might be thoroughly broken up and the Russian children flung far and wide from their natural protectors. They have since begun the breaking up of American homes and the dispersal of American children. It has been said that President Wilson was deceived by the attentions of these bankers and by the philanthropic poses they assumed. It has been said that when he discovered the manner in which he had been misled by Colonel House, he turned against that busybody, that quote-unquote holy monk of the financial empire, and showed him the door. He had the grace to do that, and in my opinion, he deserves great credit for it. President Wilson died a victim of deception. When he came to the presidency, he had certain qualities of mind and heart which entitled him to a high place in the councils of this nation, but there was one thing he was not, and which he never aspired to be. He was not a banker. He said that he knew very little about banking. It was therefore, on the advice of others, that the iniquitous Federal Reserve Act, the death warrant of the American liberty, became law in his administration. Mr. Chairman, there should be no partnership or partisanship in matters concerning the banking and currency affairs of this country, and I do not speak with any. In 1912, the National Monetary Association, under the chairmanship of the late Senator Wilson W. Aldrich, made a report and presented a vicious bill called the National Reserve Association Bill. This bill is usually spoken of as the Aldrich Bill. Senator Aldrich did not write the Aldrich Bill. He was the tool, but not the accomplice, of the European-born Jewish bankers who for nearly 20 years had been scheming to set up a central bank in this country, and who in 1912 had spent and were continuing to spend vast sums of money to accomplish their purpose. The Aldrich Bill was condemned in the platform upon which Theodore Roosevelt was nominated in the year 1912, and in that same year, when Woodrow Wilson was nominated, the Democratic platform was adopted at the Biltmore Convention, expressly stated, quote, "We are opposed to the Aldrich Plan or a central bank," unquote. This was plain language. The men who ruled the Democratic Party then promised the people that if they were returned to power, there would be no central bank established here while they held the reins of government. 13 months later, that promise was broken, and the Wilson administration, under the tutelage of those sinister Wall Street figures who stood behind Colonel House, established here in our free country the worm-eaten monarchical institution of the quote-unquote King's Bank to control us from the top downward and to shackle us from the cradle to the grave. The Federal Reserve Act destroyed our old and characteristic way of doing business. It discriminated against our one-name commercial paper, the finest in the world. It set up the antiquated two-name paper, which is the present curse of this country, and which has wrecked every country which has ever given it scope. It fastened down upon this country the very tyranny from which the framers of the Constitution sought to save us. One of the greatest battles for the preservation of this republic was fought out here in Jackson's day, when the Second Bank of the United States, which was founded upon the same false principles as those which are exemplified in the Federal Reserve Act, was hurled out of existence. After the downfall of the Second Bank of the United States in 1837, the country was warned against the dangers that might ensue if the predatory interests, after being cast out, should come back in disguise and unite themselves to the executive and through him acquire control of the government. That is what the predatory interests did when they came back in the livery of hypocrisy and under the false pretenses obtained the passage of the Federal Reserve Act. The danger of that country was warned against. The danger that the country was warned against came upon us and is shown in the long train of horrors attendant upon the affairs of the traitorous and dishonest Federal Reserve Board and the Federal Reserve Banks. Look around you when you leave this chamber and you will see evidences of it on all sides. This is an era of economic misery, and for the conditions that caused that misery, the Federal Reserve Board and the Federal Reserve Banks are fully liable. This is an era of financed crime, and in the financing of crime, the Federal Reserve Board does not play the part of a disinterested spectator. The people of the United States are being greatly wronged. If they are not, then I do not know what quote-unquote wronging the people means. They have been driven from their employments. They have been dispossessed of their homes. They have been evicted from their rented quarters. They have lost their children. They have been left to suffer and to die for the lack of shelter, food, clothing, and medicine. The wealth of the United States and the working capital of the United States has been taken away from them and has either been locked in the vaults of certain banks and great corporations, or exported to foreign countries for the benefit of the foreign customers of those banks and corporations. So far as the people of the United States are concerned, the cupboard is bare. It is true that the warehouses and coal yards and grain elevators are full, but the warehouses and coal yards and grain elevators are padlocked, and the great banks and corporations hold the keys. The sack of the United States by the Federal Reserve Board and Federal Reserve Banks and their confederates is the greatest crime in history. Mr. Chairman, a serious situation confronts the House of Representatives today. We are the trustees of the people, and the rights of the people are being taken away from them. Through the Federal Reserve Board and the Federal Reserve Banks, the people are losing the rights guaranteed to them by the Constitution. Their property has been taken from them without due process of law. Mr. Chairman, common decency requires us to examine the public accounts of the government to see what crimes against the public welfare have been or are being committed. What is needed here is a return to the Constitution of the United States. We need to have a complete divorce of bank and state. The old struggle that was fought out here in Jackson's day must be fought over again. The independent United States Treasury should be reestablished, and the government should keep its own money under lock and key in the building the people provided for that purpose. Asset currency, the device of the swindler, should be done away with. The government should buy gold and issue United States currency on it. The business of the independent bankers should be restored to them. The state banking system should be freed from coercion. The Federal Reserve districts should be abolished, and state boundaries should be respected. Bank reserves should be kept within the borders of the states whose people own them, and this reserve money of the people should be protected so that the international bankers and acceptance bankers and discount dealers cannot draw it away from them. The exchanges should be closed while we are putting our financial affairs in order. The Federal Reserve Act and the Federal Reserve Banks, having violated their charters, should be liquidated immediately. Faithless government officers who have violated their oaths of office should be impeached and brought to trial. Unless this is done by us, I predict that the American people, outraged, robbed, pillaged, insulted, and betrayed as they are in their own land, will rise in their wrath and send a president here who will sweep the money changers out of the temple. Unquote. Yes, I had to break because I was tearing up. From the above speech, it may be noted that the concerns raised by the Labour Party in South Africa during the debate in the South African Banking and Currency Bill that, quote, what had been done in the USA was not in the interests of the public, but of the banks, unquote, were fully justified. That the naive and foolish legislators of 1920 allowed the South African Reserve Bank to be established as a replication of the U.S. Federal Reserve Bank, which Congressman McFadden described as being, quote, one of the most corrupt and evil institutions in the world, unquote, is a matter of deep regret and must be censured in the strongest terms. Clifford Hugh Douglas. Clifford Hugh Douglas, 1879 to 1952, was an engineer who, while working as assistant superintendent at the Royal Aircraft Factory at Farnborough, England, during World War I, noticed that the total costs of goods were greater than the sums paid in lieu of wages, salaries, and dividends. He decided to investigate this disconnect in the way money flowed through industry, and after collecting data from hundreds of companies, found that there was a persistent deficit in purchasing power of consumers relative to total costs of production. He considered income tax to be a negative dividend and instead proposed the payment of a national dividend to all citizens, which would bridge the gap between earnings and prices. This dividend would provide consumers with the additional buying power necessary to absorb all the current production of goods in a non-inflationary manner. This forms part of Douglas's A plus B theorem, that prices are always being generated at a faster rate than incomes are produced, so that the total prices of all goods in the economy at any particular stage exceed the total buying power of consumers. Douglas's economic theory, known as social credit, advocated the transfer of the money creation process from the private banks, which create money out of nothing as an interest-bearing debt,
to a state bank. Scrolling past pictures. He also proposed a price adjustment mechanism called the just price. This mechanism would reduce prices by a percentage as a consequence of physical efficiencies introduced into the production process through the improvements in technology. In this manner, the benefits of technology would flow directly to the workers and increase their standard of living. Douglas was very aware of the fact that these increasing technological advances would make the attainment of full employment an impossibility. Hence his insistence on the payment of a national dividend, which was calculated by adding to a basic income the increase in national production and consumption of data. After World War I, Douglas devoted the rest of his life to the promotion of his ideas and gave lectures in many countries, including Australia, Canada, Japan, New Zealand, and Norway. He achieved two notable successes, one, the Social Credit Party obtained control of the provincial government of Alberta, Canada, in 1935, and two, after a lecture tour in Japan in 1929, his policies were adopted by the Japanese government in 1932. Douglas's policies were much feared by the international bankers, and in the 1930s, they put up a very considerable sum of £5 million in order to counter his highly successful program of public enlightenment. Douglas had nothing but disdain for central banking, and on one occasion, while delivering a speech in Newcastle upon Tyne, in 1937, he described the Bank of England as being a quote-unquote mental institution. Irving Norton Fisher. Irving Fisher, 1867 to 1947, was a famous professor of economics at Yale University who adopted a mathematical approach to resolving economic problems. He is well known for his utility theory, which juxtaposed the measurability of the utility function to demand theory. In his treatise, The Theory of Interest, he observed the changes in the value of goods relative to changes in time and interest rates. This later became known as the quantity theory of money. Throughout his life, he was active in the eugenics movement. In March 1913, Senator Robert L. Owen, chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, tried to introduce an alternative bill to the fraudulent Rothschild-Rockefeller banking and currency proposal. The bill would have allowed for the inclusion of staple commodities as part of the monetary base, in addition to gold and silver, and would thereby have prevented the possibility of either inflation or deflation, and would have created true freedom of employment. Irving Fisher assisted Owen in the drafting of this bill, but was subsequently blackmailed into withdrawing his support. The following illuminating paragraph, extracted from Emanuel Josephson's The Federal Reserve Conspiracy and Rockefeller's, Their Gold Corner, describes what transpired. Quote, "The conspirators determined to block the adoption of the Owen Bill. They had Professor Fisher summoned before the Yale officials and confronted with the charge that he was so, quote-unquote, foolish as to advocate money based on commodities other than gold. He was warned, related Senator Owen, that there would be no place at Yale or in any other university for anyone so, quote-unquote, foolish. Professor Fisher was keenly aware of the side on which, quote, his bread was buttered, unquote, and was no more principled, unfortunately, than are the multitude of, quote-unquote, professors prostituted to the conspirators and their foundations. He succumbed to the conspirators' blackmail, double-crossed Senator Owen, and withdrew his professional support of the honest remedial bill that he had helped draft. In its place, Professor Fisher announced his advocacy of what he mockingly labeled a quote-unquote commodity dollar, the value of which was to be determined by a quote-unquote gold index. That would block the stabilization of the economy by making speculative the value of commodities, of gold, and of the dollar, and would enhance the power of the conspirators to manipulate, or quote-unquote manage, the economy to enable them more readily to swindle the nation. The coup de grace was given to Senator Owen's honest, stabilizing currency and banking bill by its flat and categoric rejection by President Wilson," unquote.
Having relented after his previous betrayal of Senator Owen's efforts to amend the currency and banking bill, in 1920 Fisher published a book, Dollar Stabilization, which contained what later became known as the Chicago Plan. The plan was privately issued as a 6-page memorandum and distributed to 40 individuals on the 16th of March, 1933. It advocated that the state should create the nation's money supply and that private banks should operate as full reserve banks. Using mathematical principles, Fisher was able to prove that full employment would be the result, business cycles would be abolished, and inflation would be reduced and remain at zero. In August 2012, two researchers at the International Monetary Fund, Jeremiah Bennis and Michael Kumhoff, produced the Chicago Plan Revisited. They found that every one of Fisher's findings was 100% correct. Their conclusion is cited in full. Quote, "This paper revisits the Chicago Plan, a proposal for fundamental monetary reform that was put forward by many leading economists, U.S. economists, at the height of the Great Depression. Fisher, 1936, in his brilliant summary of the Chicago Plan, claimed that it had four major advantages ranging from greater macroeconomic stability to much lower debt levels throughout the economy. In his paper, we are able rigorously to evaluate his claims. In this paper, we are able to rigorously evaluate his claims. By applying the recommendations of the Chicago Plan to a state-of-the-art monetary DSGE model that contains a fully micro-funded and carefully calibrated model of the current U.S. financial system, the critical feature of this model is that the economy's money supply is created by banks through debt rather than being created debt-free by the government. Quote, "Our analytical and simulation results fully validate Fisher's 1936 claims. The Chicago Plan could significantly reduce business cycle volatility caused by rapid changes in banks' attitude towards credit risk. It would eliminate bank runs, and it would lead to an instantaneous large reduction in the levels of both government and private debt. It would accomplish the latter by making government-issued money, which represents equity in the Commonwealth, rather than debt, the central liquid asset of the economy, while the banks concentrate on their strength, the extension of credit to investment projects that require monitoring and risk management expertise. We find that the advantages of the Chicago Plan go even beyond those claimed by Fisher. One additional advantage is large, steady state output gains due to the removal or reduction of multiple distortions, including interest rate risk spreads, distortionary taxes, and costly monitoring of macroeconomically unnecessary risks. Another advantage is the ability to drive steady state inflation to zero in an environment where liquidity traps do not exist and where monetarism becomes feasible and desirable because the government does in fact control broad monetary aggregates. This ability to generate and live with zero steady state inflation is an important result because it answers the somewhat confused claim of opponents of an exclusive government monopoly on money issuance, namely that such a monetary system would be highly inflationary. There is nothing in our theoretical framework to support this claim, and as discussed in Section 2, there is very little in the monetary history of ancient societies and Western nations to support it either." Unquote.